Okay, we can start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. And this is June 2nd, 2012. Okay, so today we'll be taking the third of the three suttas spoken to Vajragotha. This will be Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 73. We're on page 595. Okay, so over the last few weeks, we've read the earlier two suttas spoken to Vajragotha. So in the Majjhima Nikaya, we have a series of three suttas that are spoken to this wanderer named Vajragotha. And so we can see these suttas almost as describing, might call this a spiritual development of Vajragotha. And we also find in the other Nikayas, Samyutta Nikaya, and occasionally in the Anguttara Nikaya, a number of other short suttas spoken to Vajragotha. So it seems this wandering ascetic Vajragotha would often come to the Buddha in order to ask him questions. Usually they're quite deep philosophical questions. And so in the first of these three suttas, Vajragotha began by questioning the Buddha whether he claims to be omniscient, to know everything all the time. And then the Buddha said that that's not the case. And the Buddha said that what he has, or if you want to describe him, you should describe him as one who has the three higher knowledges. That's the knowledge of his past lives, his knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of sentient beings, and his knowledge of the destruction of the defilements. That's the knowledge of liberation. Then in the second sutta, the discourse to Vajragotha on fire, Vajragotha comes and questions the Buddha about the 10 disputed philosophical questions. And then finally he focuses on this question about what happens to the Tathagata, or the enlightened person, when he dies. Does he exist forever? Is he annihilated? Does he both exist and not exist? Does he neither exist nor not exist? And then the Buddha refuses to answer in any of those ways. Okay, so now we come to the third of these suttas. It's called the Greater or Longer Discourse to Vajragotha. And here, Vajragotha, when he comes to the Buddha after exchanging the greetings, he says that I've had conversations with Master Gotama over a long time. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach me in brief the wholesome and the unwholesome. I imagine the Buddha sort of, you know, like slapping his hand to his forehead and saying, it's about time he got around to something practical instead of these way out abstract philosophical questions. You know, the Buddha is not concerned with, but the Buddha is concerned with the kind of practical training So now Vajragupta says, tell me what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is good, what is bad, shan, bhushan, gausukwa. Okay, so then Vajragupta says, teach me in brief, but the Buddha says, I can teach you what is wholesome and unwholesome in brief. I could teach it in detail. I could teach it both in brief. Well, then he says, still I will teach you the wholesome and unwholesome in brief. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain. He's actually going to explain both in brief and in detail. Okay, so first he says he's going to speak about what are called the roots of the unwholesome and the roots of the wholesome. In Pali, we have these expressions. Okay, you can put here. Kusala mula and akusala mula. Yeah, what's called ukusala, that means unwholesome or bad, bhushan. Okay, and then the root from which everything unwholesome comes, that is called the akusala mula. Bhushan kan. Okay, so there are three roots of the unwholesome or unwholesome roots. These three roots, the unwholesome roots, are greed, hatred or anger, and delusion. And then the opposite of that is the three wholesome roots. The word for wholesome is kusala in Pali. It means good, beneficial, or good, beneficial, wholesome. And then we have three wholesome roots. They're usually described in the text negatively, but they imply positive qualities. So the three wholesome roots are non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. What would be positive manifestation of non-greed?
Generosity.
Yeah, exactly. Generosity. Giving, excuse me?
Gratitude.
I'm not sure exactly that it would be. It's a wholesome quality, but it's more generosity or giving. And it also includes the ability to give up, in other words, the capacity for renunciation. Okay, then the opposite of non-hatred would be compassion is a wholesome quality, but it's not the most direct opposite of non-hatred.
Metta, loving kindness?
Yeah, exactly. Metta, loving kindness. And probably also connected with it would be another quality that I think of. Opposite of hatred or anger. Something I'm sure that we all have to Well, goodwill is sometimes used as an alternative rendering of metta, something we usually all have to struggle with in the course of the day.
Love.
What was that?
Love.
Well, we said loving kindness. Opposite of anger.
Just be patient.
Yeah. He said it, yes.
I'm waiting to make a joke.
Oh, you said to me to be patient.
No, I answered Bande's question.
Yeah, you answered it. I thought for a moment I should have said, I'm being patient, waiting for an answer. Okay, so patience. You don't get angry, you're patient. Okay, then the opposite of non-delusion would be... Speak more loudly.
Paying attention, heedfulness.
Not exactly. Actually, right view is one aspect, but I'm looking for another word, which is one or two words, which more precise.
Cultivating wisdom.
Well, wisdom. Wisdom is one, or understanding, or insight, you would say. Okay, and these qualities, greed, hatred, delusion, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, they're called the roots because from a root, everything grows. You know, all the plants grow from their roots. You have trees, bushes, flowers, they all have roots. Then the flower grows out from a flower, the tree, or the bush. Grows out from the roots. And so we have states of mind, which can be wholesome and unwholesome, and many other mental qualities which are wholesome and unwholesome. To take, for example, gratitude, mentioned earlier. Gratitude, we could say, it's a pretty complex quality, actually. But it certainly has wholesome roots. That maybe it's rooted in non-hatred or loving-kindness. If it's expressed in action, you know, returning gifts that are given to one or repaying the kindness of others, then it becomes a manifestation of non-greed. In the Abhidhamma, like whole lists of unwholesome and wholesome qualities are given, and then they are connected with the wholesome and unwholesome roots. Okay, but here the Buddha is concerned primarily with the actions which come out from these roots. And we find this often elaborated in the suttas. So here we have the Buddha speaking first about the in each group, he'll put the unwholesome first, followed by the wholesome. So we have killing living beings is unwholesome, and abstention from killing living beings is wholesome. What's going to take place here, or what's going to be presented here, is the set of what are called the 10 ukusala, 10 unwholesome courses of action, and the 10 wholesome courses of action. So we have, first I'm going to go through and just take the unwholesome first, then we go through and take the wholesome. It's easier that way. Okay, so the unwholesome, killing living beings, taking what is not given, misconduct in regard to sensual pleasures, false speech, malicious, or maybe better, divisive speech, speech that is intended to divide people who are on friendly terms, who are united. Then harsh speech, or angry speech. And then idle chatter or gossip. And then the next three are called covetousness, it's a rather awkward expression, ill will and wrong view. So if we look at these 10 unwholesome deeds, do you notice anything about how they can be divided? Any distinction between them in terms of groups that they might fall into?
They divide into bodily action, mental action, and verbal action.
Exactly. But you got the order a little bit out, but you got the three correct.
Yeah,
they're bodily action, verbal action, and purely mental action. So what is the bodily action?
Killing.
Yeah. Continue. Oh, you don't have the book in front of you. Oh.
Sexual misconduct.
Okay. Anything else?
Stealing.
Taking what is not given. Okay. So we have three bodily and verbal or what? What are they?
Idle chatting, gossiping.
Yeah.
False speech.
Okay, false speech.
Malicious speech.
Yeah, malicious or divisive speech.
Harsh speech.
And then idle chatter we have. And then the other three are purely mental. That's covetousness. That means wanting to get possession or wanting to take over the possessions of others. You know, it doesn't actually steal, but one wants to get what belongs to others. Then ill will, you don't physically or verbally harm another, but you really wish, I want that son of a gun to get into a car accident or to get dismissed from his job or to stumble and get sick. Some kind of bad wishes like that. And then wrong view here, the way it's explained, means especially the view that you can do bad actions, good actions, but they don't bring any results, so that there's no karmic result of action. But if we look at these 10 unwholesome actions, we divide them bodily, verbal, and mental. But according to the Buddha's teaching, what is their common source? Where do they all come from? I thought you said it. Speak more loudly. They come from the Noble Eightfold. No. I said, where do they all come from? Where do they all originate from? Well, the bad roots, but one word. No. No. Maybe I'm not specific enough. We have body, speech, and mind.
Mind.
Exactly. They're all coming from the mind, because the bad roots are factors of the mind. But the distinction is how they're expressed. If the bad state of mind is expressed in bodily action, then it becomes a bodily deed. If it's expressed in verbal action, then it becomes a verbal deed. And if one just thinks the thoughts without acting on them, then it's a mental deed. So the mind is the common factor in all 10 of these actions. Though 7 of them come to outer expression, 3 of them just remain sort of sealed up inside. Okay, then we have the opposite. We have abstaining from killing, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct, abstaining from false speech, abstaining from malicious speech, abstaining from harsh speech, abstaining from idle chatter. Then we have, this is a little bit awkward expression, non-covetousness, non-ill will, and right view. Here, when these are stated concisely, they're stated in the negative as abstaining from this or that. But each one implies also a positive quality or positive way to act that goes along with it. To get the full positive explanation, you can look, I won't go through it now, but in Sutta number 41, for example, takes the 10 unwholesome actions, the 10 wholesome actions, and then elaborates on each one. Okay, so now coming to the end of this exposition, the Buddha says, I'm at the end of section 5, the Buddha says, in this way, 10 things are unwholesome and 10 things are wholesome. And now the Buddha is going to change the topic a little bit. I think to show the one who has completely transcended the unwholesome. And so he brings in the monk who's an arhat. He says, when a bhikkhu has abandoned craving, cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it so that it is no longer subject to future arising, then that bhikkhu is an arahant, one who has destroyed the taints or the asavas, the inwardly flowing defilements, one who has lived the holy life, who has done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the goal, destroyed the fetters that bind one to the round of existence, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. Why do you think the Buddha brings in the figure of the arhat here? It seems a little bit sort of disconnected from what went just before it. Any ideas? Anybody have any ideas? Yeah, please.
Perhaps Vajrayogata has a lot of understanding, so he wants to bring it up to that level.
Maybe that's a good suggestion. Any other suggestions?
Actually, I think the answer is in a couple more paragraphs, Vajrayogata actually knows a lot the way he questioned it.
This is a very interesting point, yeah. Okay. I don't have a fixed answer in my mind. So I'm not sort of trying to test whether you got the answer or not. But I think Marcy's suggestion is good, that it seems that Vajra to sort of bring up the level of understanding. And also, maybe he sees that by bringing in the figure of the arhat, he has an opening to start, you know, a deeper discussion with Vajrayogata. But just don't ask what happens after death. Okay, so once he brings up the issue of the arahat, then Vajrayogata starts asking a series of questions. And I have to say, my personal opinion, it relates to the point Johnny brought up. You know, the way the questions are framed, I just can't believe that Vajrayogata really asks these questions in exactly that way. It seems to me that the compilers of the texts want to bring out this point about the Buddha's teaching, or bring out certain points about the Buddha's teaching. And so they put the questions in Vajragotha's mouth, you know, using very exact technical terminology. Otherwise, it's difficult to believe that somebody who hadn't been exposed to, you know, a lot of inner discourses of the Buddha would have known how to express the questions in exactly that way. Okay, first, Vajragotha asks, apart from Master Gotama, from the Buddha, is there any other monk, your disciple, who has realized for himself with direct knowledge and enters and abides in the deliverance of mind, I like liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints? So Vajragotha knows that the Buddha is completely liberated in mind, liberated by wisdom. But Vajragotha wants to know, are there any other monks, your disciples, who have reached the final goal just as you have? Then the Buddha says, there are not only 100 or 200, 300, 500, but even more bhikkhus, my disciples, who have attained this liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. In other words, this liberation by mind, liberation by wisdom, is the defining mark of what kind of person. What is the status or stature of one who has reached liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom? Yeah, that's the sort of the criterion for being an arahant. And so we have this expressed in two ways. We have chaito vimutti, panya vimutti. It's actually called anasava chaito vimutti, panya vimutti. Okay, so it's called anasava. That means that it's free from the asavas. The asavas are the most basic defilements. That's the, usually the texts speak about three asavas, things that flow into the mind and sort of corrupt it. That is the influx of craving for sensual pleasures, the influx of attachment to conditioned existence, and the influx of ignorance, basic or beginningless ignorance. And so when these asavas have been cut off at the root, then one attains this state which is without the asavas, anasava. And it's called chaito vimutti, panya vimutti. Both words are used together. Because in the suttas, we come across different types of liberation of mind, which are not permanent. They're just temporary. That is, for example, the texts speak about metta chaito vimutti, the liberation of the mind through loving kindness. That is, when one practices loving kindness, the meditation on loving kindness, to the point where it becomes deep and immeasurable, like the level of the jhanas, the mind is very pure, very bright, very radiant. But as long as one is in that state, the defilements are not present, but they can come up at a later time. Or somebody who attains the jhanas, the meditative absorptions, we could say that's a chaito vimutti, a liberation of mind that's temporary. But this is the liberation of mind that comes through panya or prajna, that is wisdom or insight. So it's wisdom or insight that cuts off the defilements, and then the liberation of mind becomes permanent. So it's something that can never be lost. Okay, so now the Buddha says that he has, you know, more than 500 monk disciples who have achieved this liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. In other words, more than 500 monks, many more are arahants. Okay, now comes an important statement. Apart from Master Gotama, that's the Buddha, and the bhikkhus, is there any one bhikkhuni, that's a nun, your disciple, who has achieved liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom? Then the Buddha says there is not, again, not only 100, but far more, even than 500 of my bhikkhuni disciples who have achieved liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. Okay, so we see the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, more than 500 of each, have reached the state of arhatship. Then comes the next question. He says, apart from Master Gotama, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, is there any one man lay follower, your disciple, clothed in white, leading a life of celibacy, who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, will reappear or be reborn spontaneously and attain final nibbana there, that is, in some other realm, without ever returning from that world to this world, to the world of sensual desire? Okay, this is a kind of, you call it a technical textual expression, which indicates a disciple at what level. Some of you who have been coming for a long time should be able to answer. Exactly, Johnny said it, a non-returner. We have here the characteristic of the non-returner is first eradicating the five lower fetters. Now, a tough question. What are the five lower fetters? No.
I'll stop the first one, please. Identity view.
Okay, this is identity view or view of a personal self?
Doubt.
Okay, good. Doubt.
Blindly observance of rituals.
Okay, that's the way it's sometimes translated, but more accurately it would be like clinging or misunderstanding. Different kinds of rituals and other observances.
Sensual lust.
Okay, sensual lust.
Ill will.
And ill will, very good, excellent. Okay, so those are the five lower fetters. View of self, doubt, clinging to rituals and observances, sensual lust, and ill will. So those five fetters keep one tied to, we call, the realm of sensual desire, whether the human realm, the lower heavens, or the states of misery. like the animal realm or the hell realms. And so the non-returner has cut off those five fetters, but he's not yet fully liberated. Rather, he will be reborn spontaneously, not through birth from a womb or anything in that form, but they arise spontaneously, usually in a set of realms which are called the pure abodes. Those are, I don't have personal experience. I guess they're very blissful, very luminous realms, and the lifespan is probably very long. And to get reborn into the pure realms, you know, you have to show your ticket of admission, and the ticket of admission is being a non-returner. You know, even if you're a noble one of a lower level and you come knocking on the pure abode saying, please, can I get in? The gatekeeper will say, let me see your ticket. He'll look at it. Stream enterer? No. Go away. So if we go try to get in, no, they'll kick us out. Unless you get to be a non-returner. Okay, so the non-returners are reborn in these higher realms, and then they reach final liberation there. And something important here in this description, what do we notice? The way the question is phrased. Something different from the way the first two questions are phrased.
And become independent of others in the teacher's disciplines?
No, I'm asking about section 9, the one on the non-returner, the description of it. There's something strikingly different.
Are they assuming the non-returner is not a monk?
Yeah, that's the point. It's not so much that monks can't become non-returners, but Vachikota is, or the text, we could say, whether Vachikota asked it in this way, that I don't know, but it's acknowledging that non-returnership becomes open to lay followers, to lay disciples. Okay, this raises the question, can a lay person achieve arhatship? And there are some examples in the text of lay people who attain arhatship. But what always happens after they attain arhatship is what?
Or
they become either a monk or a nun. Like there was the case of, this was a sort of wealthy young man of Benares when the Buddha first started his ministry. His name was Yasa. He ran out. He sort of got completely disillusioned. It's very prescient, almost like a spoiled, rich, young, upper class, you know, from the New York, Upper West Side, or from Chicago, what is that? Is it the North Shore of Chicago? Coming out, you know, running out, disillusioned with this meaningless upper class existence, you know, surfeit of sensual pleasures. He comes, wakes up and starts thinking, oh, this is horrible. And he runs out and comes into the park, and there's the Buddha sitting under a tree. And so he comes up to the Buddha, and then the Buddha give some teaching to him. First he becomes a stream enterer. Then his parents come running after him, trying to catch him. And he starts preaching to his, or the Buddha preaches to the parents. And while Yasa is listening to the Buddha preach to the parents, Yasa becomes an arhat right on the spot. Still wearing his, what would it be like, I don't know these brand name, Tom, the Gap, is that a upper class? Or that's just normal? Tommy something? Tommy Hilfiger. Is that considered a sort of upper
class? Let's make it Giorgio Armani. Giorgio Armani.
Giorgio Armani. Yeah. You know, the anyway, he's well dressed and he's an arhat. But then right after he attains, then he says, Bhante, please let me go forth. And he goes forth. And then there was the consort of King Bimbisara. Her name was Kema, the Queen Kema. She came to hear the Buddha teach, and the Buddha performed this kind of feat of psychic power, whereby he showed a beautiful young woman standing next to him, fanning him. And Kema was very beautiful, and she saw this young woman next to the Buddha, really beautiful. And so she thought, wow, this woman is more beautiful than I am. But then the Buddha worked the psychic feat so that very quickly that young woman next to the Buddha got older and older and older, you know, within a matter of minutes, till she became a decrepit old lady standing there fanning the Buddha. Then she fell down to the ground and disappeared. And then Kema realized that her own beauty is transient, and she started reflecting. And then she became an arhat on the spot. And then she asked to go forth, and she became a nun. Okay, but the lay followers, those who remain in lay life, can continue as a lay person. Those who become non-returners can continue in the lay life as non-returners. But once they become a non-returner, there's something else in the description that's important. What is it? Something distinctive?
Non-return.
It actually doesn't say. Well, that we already covered the non-returning aspect. Yeah, because to become the non-returner, one cuts off sensual desire, sensual craving. And so they have no more sense desire, and so they live naturally the life of celibacy. Okay, so then the Buddha says that he has not only 100, 5 or 500, but more disciples of that class. Okay. There's a little gender bias here, which I'm not so happy with in the text. It should go after this to, if it were completely logical, it would jump right to paragraph 11. Maybe we'll do it in the modern style, make it more gender, what do you call this, gender neutral, or gender at least close to an equal level. We'll go to paragraph 11. So then Vachagota asks, apart from Master Gotama, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and the men lay followers clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, then does Master Gotama have even one or any woman lay follower clothed in white, leading a life of celibacy, who with the destruction of the five lower fetters will be reborn spontaneously and then become a non-returner? Then the Buddha says, not only 100, not only 500, but many more than that. Okay, so there's many men who are non-returners, many women non-returners. Now we go up to paragraph 10. Okay, apart from Master Gotama, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and the men lay followers, and I'll say the women lay followers, clothed in white, leading lives of celibacy, is there any one man lay follower, your disciple, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, who carries out his instruction, responds to his advice, has gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained, this is a tough word, intrepidity, it means, let's say, confidence, or fearlessness, or confidence, and become independent of others in your teaching, in the Master's teaching. Okay, then the Buddha says, there's not only 100, not only 500, but many more men lay followers who conform to this description. And then we could jump down to paragraph 12. Vajjagota asks the same thing about women lay followers. And so there are many, maybe thousands of men lay followers, women lay followers, who fit this description. Okay, they're clothed in white. Maybe that's what lay people wore most of the time, or at least on when they're like religious functions, they would wear white clothing. They enjoy sensual pleasures. That means that they're not necessarily celibate. So to attain, well, let me just put that off for a moment. We come to the, it's description, it's a, the terminology, it's a little coded, carries out his instruction, responds to his advice. Now the key expression is gone beyond doubt, which means they've gone beyond doubt because they've seen the truth of the Dhamma for themselves. So what does that imply? When going beyond doubt and being free from perplexity? Not necessarily. Yeah, it can be. Very good. Either stream returner or once returner. So those two are grouped together. They've cut off doubt, cut off perplexity, because they know the truth, the reality of the Dhamma. They've gained confidence because they know the truth, so they're confident in the teaching. And this is a very important expression. They've become independent of others in the teaching. That means they're even independent of the Buddha, because the truth of the Dhamma has, you could say, taken root within themselves, so that they know the truth for themselves. They have the Noble Eightfold Path. They have the seven factors of enlightenment. Of course, the Buddha can give them some instruction as guidance to, you know, to help them speed up their cultivation. But they know everything that has to be done. It's just a matter of, you know, getting some inspiration and from the Buddha or some instruction to speed up the process. But the stream enterer has entered the stream of the Dhamma. And so the stream is going to carry him down to the final goal. So in a maximum of seven more lives, they will reach the final goal. The once returner in a maximum of, in one more life, will reach the goal. Okay, so now the Buddha, and then coming back to that, enjoying sensual pleasures. So to become stream enterer, once returner, for a layperson, celibacy is not required, and they don't necessarily become celibate after reaching those attainments. Though, of course, I think the interest in sensual pleasures will diminish, especially for the once returner. It's not that they can be sensualists and stream enterers and once returners, but celibacy is not an invariable attribute of the noble disciples at those stages. Okay, so now we've gone through all of these classes of disciples. And so an important thing to bear in mind also is that one can have monks and nuns who are stream enterers, once returners, non-returners. But the question is, and you can have celibate lay stream enterers and once returners. But it seems that the questions are phrased in a way that will show what is the minimal requirements for each of these stages. Okay, so now after Vajragota has gone through this questioning of the Buddha, he now speaks, we call it like a long paean of praise to the Buddha's dispensation. He says, I'm in paragraph 13 on page 598. He says, Master Gotama, if only you were accomplished in this teaching, but no other monks were accomplished, then this holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because you are accomplished and there are monks who are accomplished, then the holy life is complete in that respect. Then he says, if only Master Gotama and the monks were accomplished, but if there were bhikkhunis who are not accomplished, then the holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because you and the monks and the nuns are accomplished in this Dhamma, then the holy life is complete in that respect. Okay, if only you, if it was only you, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis who were accomplished, but no men lay followers leading lives of celibacy who are accomplished, then the holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because we have lay followers wearing white, leading the celibate life who are accomplished, then the holy life is complete. Okay, if, I'm going to again make it a little more gender balanced, if there were only bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, men lay followers, it said, who are celibate, but no women lay followers who are celibate who are accomplished, then the holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because there are such women lay followers, the holy life is complete in that respect. If there were only all of the monks and nuns, the lay followers leading celibate lives, but no lay followers who are enjoying sense pleasures who are accomplished in this Dhamma, then the holy life would be deficient in that respect. But because there are both men and women lay followers who are enjoying sense pleasures, who have reached accomplishment in this Dhamma, then this holy life is complete in that respect. So I think I've gone through all of those classes. I've abbreviated somewhat. Then Vajragota uses a very beautiful simile to illustrate his impression of the Buddha's teaching. I'm in paragraph 14. He says, just as the river Ganges inclines towards the sea, slopes towards the sea, flows towards the sea, and reaches the sea, so too Master Gotama's assembly with its homeless ones, those are the renunciants, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and its householders, those are the lay people who have reached the different stages of awakening or liberation. So the whole assembly inclines towards Nibbana, slopes towards Nibbana, flows towards Nibbana, and reaches Nibbana. Okay, so now it seems that Vajragota's mind has really sort of opened up to maybe call it the splendor and the open, his mind has opened up to the full breadth, full extent of the Buddha's teaching. And so now he's going to make a somewhat surprising declaration. He says, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, you have made the Dharma clear to me in many ways, as though you were turning upright what was upside down, revealing what was hidden, showing the path to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark so those with eyesight could see forms." Now he says, "I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus." And then comes the surprising request. He says, "I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission or full ordination." So now Vachagota, I mean, he's been a wandering ascetic for probably many years. So it's quite natural for him, actually, once he gains faith in the Buddha and goes for refuge, there's no need for him to continue just as an independent wandering ascetic, but he wants to become a monastic disciple of the Buddha. So he asks for ordination. Then the Buddha says, paragraph 16, he says, "Vacha, one who formerly belonged to another sect and desires the going forth and full ordination in this Dhamma and discipline lives on probation for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, if the monks are satisfied with him, they give him the going forth and full admission to the status of a bhikkhu, of a monk." So this is the usual procedure. Actually, this has to be interpreted or explained. What actually happens if somebody from another sect wants to become a Buddhist monk or Buddhist nun, they live on probation for 4 months, which means that they actually get ordained as a novice, a samanera, samaneri. So they shave off the hair and the beard, and they wear monastic robes, and they have the status of samanera or samaneri, observing the 10 precepts. And then they remain as a novice for a minimum of 4 months so that the monks can get to know them, they could get to know the monks. And then if the monks are happy with them, with their behavior, with their attitude, then they can give them the full ordination. But the Buddha, because he's the founder of the teaching, he has a special prerogative. So he says, "But I recognize individual differences in this matter." Okay, then Vachagota says, "If those who formerly belong to another sect have to live on probation for 4 months before they can get full ordination, then I will live on probation for 4 years. And if the monks are satisfied with me, they can give me the ordination." So he's showing that by this, that his trust and confidence now in the Buddha is really firmly rooted. But the Buddha, because he has this prerogative, the Buddha authorizes him to get the ordination right away. Okay, so then the wonder of Vachagota received the going forth and received full ordination. Maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything that's been covered so far. When you read the word what?
Sensuousness and that attachment. I also feel that, and this is, I'm asking if this is correct or incorrect, in relation to the exhortation to eat once a day and before noon, I feel like there's a very strong sensuous bond or sensate craving to eating.
Yeah.
That can sometimes I substitute knowing, well, sensuousness refers to celibacy, and that is important, but also extending it to other cravings that are being exaggerated. Is that a wrong view? Or, in other words,
In addition to the innate arising celibacy or the restraint of celibacy, it seems to me that other restraints relate in the exact same way. Any other one, if one has a sensual, if I have a sensate craving in regards to excess meal or excess anything, sloth, that's in the same category.
Yeah, well, of course, to live, to survive, one has to eat. Yeah, so one, you know, one can't give up food, but, and then there are no sort of precepts which are ordinarily binding on the lay follower regarding food, but a lay follower who sort of wants to discipline the mind to control the craving for food would do some kind of reflection on the purpose for eating. Like the monastics, we have a reflection that I eat not for the sake of beautifying the body, for making it, I think, in India in the Buddha's time, plump bodies were considered beautiful and attractive. It doesn't agree with American culture where they prioritize people who are thin. So one reflects that I don't eat in order to make myself plump and attractive. And I don't eat for the purpose of amusement or for intoxication, you know, becoming intoxicated with taste. But I eat for the purpose of sustaining and supporting this body, for preserving my life, and for living the spiritual life. And so one could do a reflection like that to control the craving for food.
And it seems like that once one looks at that, then eating more than once a day points to other than being with family and normal schedules, that eating once a day is really sufficient and very fortunate to eat.
Yeah, though having one meal a day is actually not compulsory for monastics. In the southern tradition, most monastics take two meals, a breakfast and then a lunch. But it's all of the meals have to be finished before midday.
So that came up in the second area of Ajigota, of 10 disciplines. There's another sutta, I think it's at Kavata, where he lists types of location, and one of them specifically says refraining from destroying seed and plant life.
Yeah, that's a monastic precept. It's not because plants or seeds are considered to have consciousness, to have some kind of awareness. Because there's no precept against lay people, you know, farmers, destroying the seeds. And even novices can pluck plants, even novice monks. It's just for the fully ordained monks. And that is because in the Buddha's time, there were some of the sects believed that every life form, including plants and flowers, well, plants are flowers, that including plants and seeds had a one faculty kind of consciousness. And so when they saw that monks destroyed plants, then they complained to the Buddha. So the Buddha laid down that precept just to conform to the common belief of the time.
There are three questions from the internet.
Okay, let's take your name again.
See you.
See you, okay.
Yeah.
Wait, take the microphone. So.
Just leave it louder so that.
Yeah, it should be okay.
In India, the 10 apusaras, why wasn't intoxicants?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, I'll repeat the question. Why don't we find the precept against using intoxicants included in the list of the 10 unwholesome actions? You know, I haven't found this explained in the suttas themselves, but this is my understanding. Okay, the 10 unwholesome deeds are actions which in themselves are create unwholesome karma. So the Buddha, in laying down the 5 precepts, let me just put it this way. Okay, the 10 unwholesome actions are actions which in themselves create unwholesome karma. Now, drinking an intoxicant in itself doesn't create the unwholesome karma. Whether drinking tea or drinking an intoxicant, it's just drinking a substance. But of course, when you drink the intoxicant, it has a dulling effect on the mind. But in itself, it doesn't create the unwholesome karma. But if somebody comes under the influence of the intoxicant, then they can violate one of the strong unwholesome actions. And so in the code of the 5 precepts, the Buddha is laying down a practical code of guidance for the lay community. So he includes abstaining from intoxicants, because if intoxicants are allowed, then people will get intoxicated, then they might break the other 4 precepts. But in the 10 types of unwholesome action, it's just the actions which in themselves are unwholesome. Okay, let's get the questions that came from the internet. And I want to finish the sutta today.
Is there 3 questions, comment, another question?
Okay. One is that the Chinese translation of asava means leaking. So outflow may be a better translation than influx or inflow, because the monkey mind tends to outflow. I mean, some have used outflow, some have used inflow. It's a matter of debate which one is more suitable. And the commentaries explain asava in both ways, flowing in and flowing out. Okay, question 2. In the word chaito vimuti, is chaito related to chaitana? Actually, both chaito and chaitana are related to the word chitta, which means mind. Okay, then somebody says section 12 is saying even gays and lesbians could become stream enterers and once returners, but they won't have any more sex if they develop further as non-returners. Did the Buddha specifically address LGBT issues, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender issues? Actually, for lay people, the Buddha doesn't say anything about that. There's no condemnation of people who are homosexual, no banishing of them for anything. If there's any kind of, within the monastic order, any kind of sexual relationships, whether heterosexual or homosexual, then it's out of the Sangha. It's prohibited. There are cases of, a little bit strange, of a monk, I think, who spontaneously underwent transgender, not through any operation or chemical, but he became a female. The Buddha didn't negate his ordination, but I think sent him over to become a bhikkhuni, to join the bhikkhuni sangha. Okay, it seems like another quote. Oh, I see. Okay, this is a discussion between 2 of the viewers. Okay. I'm going to try to finish a little quickly. Okay, so Vajragota gets admitted as a monk, and then a half month after his full ordination, I'm at the top of page 600, so he comes to the Buddha. He's now called the Venerable Vajragota. He comes to the Buddha and says, I have attained whatever can be attained by the knowledge of a disciple in higher training, by the true knowledge of a disciple in higher training, let the Blessed One, the Buddha, teach me further. So what has Vajragota achieved in these 2 weeks? Whatever can be attained by a disciple in higher training. Not yet arhat. Okay, this is a rather technical expression. The word here in Pali is seka. And there's a distinction made between... The dog is trying to escape from his post. Get back, Fido! Yeah, distinction is made between seka and aseka. A seka means a disciple who's still in training. Specifically, it means one who is at the three lower stages of realization. Stream enterer, once returner, non-returner. Then the arhat is called aseka, which means non-trainer, non-learner. Not like, you know, somebody like me... Not so key. Not in that sense, you know, like an ordinary guy in the street who doesn't train at all. But it means, you could say, to bring out the sense, I translated it, one who is beyond training, who has finished the training. Okay, so when Vajragota says that he's attained whatever can be attained by a seka, he's indicating he's still a seka, he's still in training. But where is he? In relation to the training.
If he's not...
Speak up.
Are you referring to one of the categories of...
Yeah.
So if he's not... He's living as a renunciant up until this point, or not a renunciant of Buddha? And so I guess that would make him a non-returner?
He's a non-returner, yeah. He's now been practicing for 2 weeks as a monk, Buddhist monk, but he must have had perhaps a lot of practice and training through his years as a wandering ascetic, and so he would have made very quick progress, and he's reached the level of non-returner. And now he wants the Buddha to give him some further instruction in order to progress further to arhatship. So he says, develop two things further. That is serenity and insight. That's samatha and vipassana. When you've developed these two things further, they will lead to the penetration of many elements. Then the Buddha is going to state here what are these elements, or you could say realizations, that they'll lead to. I'm not going to go into these in detail here, but just quickly. One is the various psychic powers to multiply one's body, to pass through solid objects, to sink into the ground, to fly in space, and so on. The second is the divine ear through which one could hear sounds at a great distance or even in other realms of existence. Third is the ability to read the minds of others, to know what their state of mind is. Fourth is the recollection of one's own past lives. Fifth is the divine eye with which one can see beings passing away and taking rebirth and understand how beings move on according to their karma. And then the sixth is the knowledge of the destruction of defilements. In other words, the attainment of arhatship. Okay, so now the Buddha has given this advice to Vajragota. Vajragota goes, he expresses his appreciation. He goes off and he lives alone, withdrawn, and so on, in solitude, practicing diligently. And then before long, he realizes the supreme goal of the homeless life. And then he directly knows birth is finished. We could say the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of conditioned existence. And then the Venerable Vajragota became one of the arahats. Okay, so now Vajragota is an arhat. Then on one occasion, a number of monks were going to see the Blessed One. I assume that at this time, Vajragota must have gone off maybe to another location, not living close to the Buddha. Otherwise, Vajragota could have gone himself. So Vajragota sees them in the distance. He asks them, "Where are you going?" And they say, "We're going to see the Buddha." Okay, now I'm at the top of 602. Then Vajragota wants to give a message to the Buddha. He says, "In that case, you may pay your respects to the Buddha on my behalf, and then tell the Buddha that the Bhikkhu Vajragota pays homage to you, and say, the Blessed One has been worshipped by me. The Sublime One has been worshipped by me." And that's the kind of way in which he's indicating that he's worshipped the Buddha in the way that the Buddha praises, that is, by attaining the final goal. Okay, so now the monks go to the Buddha and they convey this message to the Buddha, and then the Buddha says, he interprets the message correctly. He says, "Bhikkhus, having encompassed his mind with my own mind," that is, even though the Buddha was living some distance away through his supernormal power of knowledge, he could know what is going on in Vajragota's mind. He says, "I already knew of the Bhikkhu Vajragota that he has attained the three true knowledges." What are the three true knowledges? Okay, the recollection of past lives, knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, and the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, and that he has great supernormal power and might. This seems to be referring to the other kinds of attainments that Vajragota reached, especially this first one, the various kinds of psychic power. And then the Buddha continues and says, "And deities also told me that Vajragota has attained the three true knowledges and has great supernormal power and might." Okay, so Vajragota ends as an arhat. And he would have lived on, I guess, we don't have an account of the rest of his life. He would have lived on for the rest of his life and then passed away into final nibbana. Okay, and that is the end of the sutta and the end of the three suttas on Vajragota. Okay, so next week, we'll take sutta number 74 next week. That is called Digha Naka Sutta. This is interesting discussion with the nephew of Sariputta, who tries to debate with the Buddha and to defeat the Buddha in debate. Okay, any questions on anything that came up? This part. Oh, Marcy.
I guess we've been studying this sutta before. I don't remember. I think we did. We studied this sutta before, but I don't remember it because I didn't have any notes.
focus on it until the very end, and you had circled the word worship, and it seems like you had decided that it might have been the word serve.
Actually, that's actually true. I was thinking that while I was reading it. Yeah, parichino, I think, is the Pali word. And worship, I think, not so satisfactory. Because when any monk comes to the Buddha and, you know, pays homage to him, you could say that's worshiping him. But it's more like served him. That conveys the sense better. Thank you for bringing that up. So while one is practicing the teaching, you could say one is serving the Buddha through one's practice. And when one completes the practice, then one uses the past tense, or it's called the past perfect. I have served the Buddha, because one has completed the practice. Okay, so we'll do the sharing of the merits. And I put this up, by the way, the verses of sharing the merit is on the Baos website, where my course listing is situated. You find the sharing of the merits there and the basic meditation instructions that I gave a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it's about a month ago now. Are there. No, it was 3 weeks ago. No, it was a month ago. Okay, so we share the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang param. Eta vatajam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatajam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatajam hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sat anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavag upadaya avici hetato etantare satakai upapanna rupi arupi cha asanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbuting. Okay, we could end by paying homage to the Buddha.
Out of the bundle.